Agile for Humans, episode 10.
Processes and tools dominate today's Agile discussions, but we are devoted to the individuals and interactions that make it work. From the beginner to the veteran practitioner, we have something for you. Welcome to Agile for Humans.
All right, welcome to this week's episode of Agile for Humans. I'm your host, Ryan Ripley. Joining me tonight, Ron Quartel, at Agile Agitator on Twitter. AgileAgitator.blogspot.com is his blog site. He's an Agile coach and the creator of the new Agile framework, Fast Agile. Ron, how are you doing tonight?
Good, thanks. Very excited to be here. Thank you.
Yeah, thanks for joining us. I'm excited that Amitai Schleyer, a friend of the show, good friend of mine, and I think a friend of yours as well, recommended you as a really interesting person to talk to. I'm glad he connected us, because after going through your blog site and the Fast Agile materials, there's a lot of really interesting stuff that you've been cooking up lately.
Yeah, it's stuff that's been going on in my head for a while, and I finally kind of built up the courage and put it together and packaged it, and now trying to really market it and get some traction and some interest going.
Perhaps we can start with the Fast Agile. Your site there is fast-agile.com. Interesting framework. Looks like it's really turning the delivery to up to 11. It's really looks like a leaned out, but perhaps a leaned out version of Scrum with some craftsmanship mixed back in. Is that a fair way to start?
Yes. Yeah. I've kind of described it as a mix of open space technology with Scrum and XP and story mapping. Essentially, if you put all of those into a blender, then you're going to come out with Fast Agile.
I'm a fan of the open space technology. This past year, I was able to go to a few conferences that used it. Really found it at first seemed odd, but when you experience it, incredibly powerful. How do you bring that into an Agile framework?
Yeah, I'm glad you started there, because that was how the whole idea started. So if it's okay with you, maybe I'll describe how it started, and it will kind of help fit the pieces together. So I was at the Scrum gathering down in New Orleans last year, so not this year, the year before. And the last day, it was a three day conference, and the last day of the conference was an open space. And I'd been to open space before, open space, Agile Open Northwest, for instance, and several other conferences. So I was familiar with the format. But for some reason, this time, it just struck me at the end of the where they populated the marketplace and we'd actually started going into the conference. I just sat there looking at the wall, the marketplace wall and all the sessions, and thought, you know, this is fantastic that we can get a room of 800 people and within 20 minutes we've got one day of conference. And this is a fantastic example of organization at scale. And it was like the Agile gods came and smacked me on the back of the head and said, look at that. That's an example of organization at scale. And it struck me like, hey, why aren't we using this in the Agile world? Because, I mean, SAFe is fairly new and less, and they're trying to use control mechanisms to control organization at scale. And here's a mechanism that works incredibly powerfully, incredibly well, which hasn't been tried. So that was the spark of the whole idea at that conference, to talk about that as a very idea. I said, hey, why don't we look at using open space technology to organize work amongst a large group of developers? And I spoke to a handful of people there. And that was the very first spark of it, but it took me until this year to really think it all through and put all the pieces together and formalize it into Fast. It's gone through various names as well. I think the initial name was DOS, which stood for Dunbar's Open Space. And now you'll see Dunbar's number come up later. I can talk about that. But essentially, that was the core of it, is how do I build out an Agile framework or methodology that harnesses the power of open space for self-organization.
So as I think through that, because the market space is such a powerful tool, and it seems like that becomes almost your backlog that you're working your 2-day iterations off of. And I can see how the initial benefits, as I was reading through your very well documented site, you know, first of all, WIP is incredibly limited,
right,
which is a great benefit of such a time box. But you're also really implicitly mandating mob programming.
Yes. And so I was trying not to mandate too much, because I think that's part of the reason why extreme programming has kind of fallen out of favor in place of Scrum. That's another topic. A passion of mine is extreme programming and code craftsmanship. So I was trying to work out how do I build that in but not mandate it, because I think that's what kind of has helped people move more towards Scrum than extreme programming, because they're kind of put off by the mandate. So I was trying to work out how to build that in but not build it in but not mandate it. So I built it in as one of the core values, essentially. And you're right, pair programming is one of the core practices within extreme programming, and you'll see I mentioned that several times through the website. But also, I love the concept of mob programming, of like turning the pair programming dial to 12, because I think pair programming, you're already at 11. So they discovered right. A 12 on the dial and said, hey, let's get a mob programming.
Now, you mentioned Dunbar's number, which I, as your site documents, it's the suggested cognitive limit to the number of people that we can actually interact with. And I think the number is 150, if I'm recalling it correctly.
Yeah.
Now, have you seen Fast Agile scale up to 150 yet? Is this something that, from one perspective, open space conferences certainly scale larger than that? So I think that proves out the theory that it can go that high. But as far as a software development team, are you working in numbers up to 150 developers, or are we still in this early stage of trying this out with smaller teams?
Yes. So FAST is not being done anywhere yet. So right now, FAST is a proposal for an experiment. And so really, I'm looking for companies that are really cutting edge, that are open to experimentation. And really, you've got to be at the right point in your product life cycle or project to say, hey, why don't we try this out for a month or 2 months, because this could really be a game changer. So I was reading a book on Scrum and how Sutherland kind of managed to build Scrum out, and he had a relationship with one of his clients. So he was fortunate enough to do that. I'm looking for that same kind of relationship. So a client out there that says, you know what, nothing else is working. Why don't we try this? We've got nothing to lose. So the Dunbar's number, it's a theoretical number, and based on the number of relationships that personal relationships that a person can hold. The core of agility is based on personal relationships and communication. So that's where I came up with the 150. So the image in my head was this room of 150 developers, coming Monday morning. So they turn up into what I've called the forum, so essentially the open space area. And 150, up to 150 of them come in there, and they will form dynamic teams around a backlog. Should I go through the elevator pitch?
I think that'd be great.
Yeah.
And then I'd like to come back to how let's hold here for a second.
Okay.
So what you just described, though, is the first time I've heard of a framework actually embracing and amplifying self-organization. And
yeah.
I like that aspect of it quite a bit, because you can still do Scrum with a dictator PM. And that
yes,
still is
yes.
That or a dictator Scrum Master, which is certainly an anti-pattern of Scrum Master behavior. But if you're going to put X to 150 developers into a room with a marketplace and say form dynamic teams. I mean, that really is as self-organizing as you can get. And that was one of the initial things that kind of popped out in my mind as I was reading through this, that, wow, this is the first time this has been explicitly embraced. And I really liked that aspect of it.
Yeah. But yeah. It's because you know, from Scrum experience, you know, Scrum talks about self-organizing teams. You know, the best Scrum teams that you get to see, or certainly that I've seen in my life as an Agile coach, are the ones that are given the space to self-organize. And unfortunately, that's rare, because more often than not, companies will do, they'll say, okay, we're going to do Scrum, but their description of Scrum is essentially just taking a waterfall backlog and delivering it iteratively. And they think that's Scrum because they're doing all the meetings, and they're creating software iteratively and even demoing it. But that's not really, that's just scratching the surface. The real power of Scrum is that self-organizing team that says, hey, we'll pull work from the backlog. You know, don't tell us what to do. Tell us what you want, and we'll be able to pull that. So understanding that's the real underlying power behind Scrum, and being frustrated at how that's not really being taken up, or how rarely that gets taken up. I really wanted to create a framework that only allowed for self-organization. So you can't not have self-organization. You can't tell teams what to do. You can't tell anyone what to do. It's a sheer pull system. And I think that will be the strength of FAST.
Yeah, it certainly shines through as you read through the I don't want to say process, but as you read through the description of the framework and how this is supposed to work out, that I think what you've done is you've embraced individuals and interactions over processes and tools. And most frameworks don't do that. You know, if you look at a SAFe diagram, it's not the culmination of a mindset of individuals and interactions. It is all process and tools. And I think to a lesser extent, Less and Dad and all these other frameworks have taken that track. As you said, it's control systems. Mm-hmm. Control systems require process, tools, heavy governance, those types of activities. Right. Individuals and interactions fall to the wayside. And what does shine through in what you've laid out here is the individuals. And so that is it's certainly inspiring. And I think you were about to go into your elevator pitch. I think that would help people, because we've, you know, being agilists, we've jumped into some of the fun parts. Yes. We're talking about the fun bits, mm-hmm. but maybe some context with the elevator pitch would help help people frame up these thoughts a little better.
Yeah, the elevator pitch is, imagine this, 150 developers. Now, FAST does require a certain office layout for us to be able to work, and it does require your team to be co-located. So I was very keen on doing away with a lot of the nonsense around Agile, like how do we make distributed teams work? You know, how do we make offshore? You know, what if the testers are in one country and the developers are in another? And so coming from extreme programming background, in extreme programming, you all work core hours and you come to work and you work together, and that's how it is. So I said, all right, FAST is going to be the same. You're going to have an office location that has the developers co-located. Now imagine there's 150 developers. Now these developers will show up on Monday, it's the first day of an iteration, and they'll show up into this large area, like an open space area, which I'm calling the forum. And they sit there, and a guy comes up. He's the project manager, kind of product owner guy. And behind him on the wall is a release map, which is essentially a story map, which represents the entire project that they're currently working on and all of the features and stories associated with it. And he says, okay, who's got working software from the last iteration that they can show us? And then someone will get off and they'll do a demonstration. The product owner goes, yep, that's great. Marks that off as done on the story map. He goes, who else? Someone will get up and they'll show some working software. And he goes, yep, that looks good. That's what I asked for. But now I'm seeing it. You know what? I'm going to want some changes. here's what I'd like. Can you move that to the left? And I want this to spin to the right and be green instead of yellow. And who knows, whatever the product owner does. So he'll create another story, stick it up on the wall. Someone else gets up, they'll show some working software, and he goes, what? That's ridiculous. You guys totally missed the boat. Why didn't you come and ask me? That's not what I wanted. What I wanted was this. Bang, bang, bang. Not done. So that story goes back on the wall. Now, the reason that we're demonstrating working software to the entire tribe is because the entire tribe now understands the state of the current system. So by the end of that session of working software from last iteration, those 150 developers all understand of the state of the current working system, what the other teams had done, and what the product owner liked, what they didn't like. Now, the product owner at this point is saying, all right, he might do some reclarification, and it's a very rah-rah meeting. So this guy's got to be dynamic. He's got to be a real true leader because he's talking to his troops, right? And really, it's about alignment, making sure everyone understands what we're trying to build. And so he'll say, look, these are my priorities. This is what I'd like to see. And these are just kind of guidelines. And so that's the first stage. So now everyone's in sync as to what the current state of the software is. The next stage is essentially the marketplace where we say go. So Joe, he's really interested in working on one story, one aspect of it. He's particularly passionate about it. So he'll jump up. And he'll grab that story. He'll go into the center of the circle and say, yeah, today I'm going to be working on this story. And here's how I'm going to be doing it. And here's why I'm passionate about it. I'm going to be in room A. And so he puts his story up on room A. Someone else gets up and they may not even pick a story. They'll say, you know, we're working on a story last week. There's a big major refactoring that we found in there. We got to start on it, but I'm going to really want to get in there and continue that. Here's what the refactoring is around, blah, 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 blah. So I'm going to be in room B. Someone else might get up and say, I'm thinking of creating a new component because I'm noticing that the architecture is moving in this direction. I think if we pull out this structure here, which will handle this API that can communicate over there. So that's what I'm going to be doing. I'll be over in room C. So I've just given three different examples there of someone doing refactoring, so they didn't pull anything off the wall, someone creating a component, so they didn't pull anything off the wall, and then someone actually pulling something off the wall. So this is how fast handles component versus feature teams, because I think that's always been a struggle. So this is three guys. Someone else will grab another story. Someone else grabs another story. So now the number of development rooms that you've got in your facilities. And as a rule of thumb, I said, whatever your tribe size is, divide it by 10, that's how many development rooms you've got. So they become the places in your marketplace. Whoever gets there first, gets there first. And that's the stories that will get worked on in that sprint or in that iteration. Now, I've pegged two-day iterations, and I'll talk about that later, but you don't have to run with two-day. You might find a week runs better. But I've especially gone small, which is one of the Agile principles, you know, that we try to aim for shorter iteration rates. So I said, well, how short can I get it? And I'm aiming for 2 days. So before you start in your 2 day iteration, you look up at the marketplace, at the wall there, at the different slots, and you say, you know what, our story is going to clash with the guys over in room A. So before we start, let's go over and talk to them and let's have an architectural discussion to make sure that we're all in alignment. So this is how we handle architecture discussions, just in time, just enough. If you're interested, so I might be over in room C, but I'm like, you know what, I want to do this important stuff, so I'll go join in there, finish the discussion, and then go back to my other room, room C. So it's using a lot of the principles of open space, like the law of 2 feet, and the right conversations will happen at the right time. So it's almost like metaphysical principles, but because I've seen them work in open space, I feel that this is going to work here. And this is how we handle then the architectural discussions. And this is how the architecture can grow and emerge with a kind of just-in-time nature.
Something that stands out there, it seems like you're definitely slicing work into very small pieces. And so I'm wondering if you could go into, I think a question that's going to flare up very quickly is, well, if we're going to work in 2 day, 3 day, 4 day, very short iterations, the work has to be small. Yeah. And so what is your estimation process? What is your slicing heuristic?
Yeah.
What is the mechanism or the process to get the story small and then confirm that it does fit in within that time box?
Right. That's a great question. So the tribe will do everything. So me as a product owner, my initial population of the release map or story map is just features. If I'm interested in working on a feature, I'll say, hey, I'm going to work on this feature. My dynamic team will come and join me in a room. There might be 10 of us. There might be 20 of us. There might be 2 of us. So then the next question is, all right, we're going to work on this feature. We're not going to get the whole feature done in 2 days. What can we get done in 2 days? So the next step is, well, okay, let's break this feature down. So we'll break the feature down into stories, or I dislike this word a lot, but I'll say it, into epics. We'll break it down into epics and stories. And we'll break it down enough to the point where we've identified something of value that we can deliver in 2 days. And the rest of whatever else we've broken down, we're just going to stick back on this, on the story map, the release wall, and we're going to deliver, we're going to work on the small chunk that we did manage to pull off. So again, the breaking down of the storage is follows that just-in-time pattern. If I'm interested in working something and it isn't broken down, then the first thing we've got to do is break it down.
I was also noting that as part of the estimation or the slicing is that you've embraced the no estimates mentality mm-hmm. towards estimating work. And I'm wondering if you could, because that's been a hot topic on the podcast. We've had conversations with, you know, George Dinwiddie, Neil Killick, J.B. Rainsberger, a lot of the no estimates advocates. We brought Tim Ottinger in and Amitai and Zach Boniker, some of the, you know, the more moderate to more extreme. In future episodes, we've even spoken with Woody Zuhl about this as well. Yeah. What is your take on no estimates? How does it fit into an open space centric framework? And what is it adding to the ability to deliver the software within your framework?
Yeah, I'm glad you asked that, because I'm struggling with that question as to how to make fast palatable to companies that are currently used to, you know, the concept of velocity and story points. So a big question around fast is how to solve a lot of the pain points around Agile right now. And that's a big one. You know, velocity and story points, there's something very distasteful in there. And, you know, no estimates is a really good experiment at trying to solve that. So the way I've worded it is that fast can run in two modes. So essentially the no estimates mode, which is as described by Woody Zuhl, you can run like that. Or there is, I've come up with like a lightweight estimation process. And the purpose really, you know, when I get talking to people about estimation, they'll say, well, why do we need estimation? And the answer that comes back is, well, before I start on a feature, I need to have a rough sizing of whether it's worth my while or not as a product owner or product manager. So they need this like large size estimation. And so that the inspiration came from listening to Thinking Fast and Slow. And then later The Wisdom of Crowds, that there's a way to estimate with very, very good accuracy fairly quickly. And so I've kind of built that into FAST. I've called it FAST estimation. Now in FAST, we only ever estimate on the feature level. So as a product owner or project manager, so in the that FAST meeting, the project manager.
That's good.
Yeah.
That's good. That's good branding right there, Ron.
It is,
I like
right?
that. Everything's FAST.
Yeah, it is. Yeah. So the manager will say, hey, I need an estimate on this feature. And we'll ask the room, we'll say, all right, on the count of three, give me your estimate in how many man days. And I've gone back to man days, which kind of it's shock and horror to a lot of people, but I can go into why.
That's blasphemy.
I know, right? how many man days is this feature? And on the count of three, you give me your estimate. And we can say, you know, round it to the nearest 20, the nearest 50, give me your estimate. And I just take the average of the room and there it is. There's my number. So in like minutes, I can estimate the size of the feature. Is it accurate? It's probably just as accurate as anything else. So let's try and find something super quick and super easy. So I can estimate the entire backlog and I've got some kind of indication of how big my backlog is. And I can repeat that process as needed to kind of gain more insight as we move through. So it's again, it's nothing new. It's not a new way of estimating, but it doesn't seem to have been used in the Agile world. Like, we're now using poker and modified ancient sequences of numbers and all sorts of other things. So it's like, hey, well, you know, let's try this.
You mentioned, and I'm wondering if this is the need that FAST is filling for you, but you mentioned that there are some pain points in Agile, and you seem, and maybe I'm reading a little too much into it, but you seem very passionate around those pain points. And I'm wondering if you could go into a few of those and maybe elaborate on if FAST is really meant to address those directly, because it seems like there are some very serious issues in the current Agile world and the way that Agile's been implemented that are troubling to you.
Yes. Yeah. That's you've read that well. For a long time, as an Agile coach, it just feels like an uphill battle. So Scrum is a great framework, but it seems to lend itself to be misapplied very easily. So my job as an Agile coach was to go in and fix Scrum over and over and over again. And it seemed to be broken in the same way where, you know, we're misunderstanding that it's a poor model. You know, they've been misunderstanding, that it is self-organization. They're misunderstanding that the teams are working out what to do, that they're the real heart and brains of it. Treating devs as like horns on a chessboard. Which is so disheartening, like, oh, you know what, we're going to change the team. So I'm going to move these people over there and those people there, and we're going to be using these processes on them. So I hear this from managers all the time. And that was disheartening. It's like, you don't get it. You guys just don't get it. You're going to take it right back to square one in your Scrum rollout. So I really, how do we get around this continual kind of classic pitfalls? So particularly around self-organization. So my passion for Agile comes from my early history as an extreme programmer. So that was my introduction to Agile. I was fortunate enough to work with an extreme programming team for about 10 years. And we got it. Like, we were a pool model. We were self-organized. We were contained. And what we did inside that team, that's what we did. So we did pair programming. We're free to learn and study technical excellent practices. And I was, ever since then, I've been looking to really recreate that same feeling of agility. And I haven't found it in the Scrum world that I've been involved with. Not to say it's not possible. I've seen glimpses of it, but there's something kind of not working there. So this is my goal of creating a system that won't lend itself to be so misapplied, particularly around self-organization, which we've spoken about at great length. But yeah, the whole estimation, which we've spoken about, estimation, stories, and the whole lingo as well. Like, it's almost like the cookie cutter. Scrum has become this cookie cutter system where I was having a conversation at the last Scrum gathering with a guy. And he comes up and he says, you know, so the topic I was talking about was focus and how, you know, how being focused is going to help you. And I gave real examples of how to focus the team. And at the end of the talk, he came up and goes, you know, my team they're just spending so long in the meetings. I'm like, well, which meetings? He goes, well, you know, at planning. I'm like, well, what are they doing in planning? He goes, well, they spend so long during tasking. I'm like, well, what's taken them so long? He goes, well, they're trying to work out the sizes. And I said, well, why don't you just stop sizing? he goes, but then how will we know if the work's going to get done? I'm like, well, why don't you trust the team and ask them, hey, come and tell me if you do think the work's not going to get done. He goes, yeah, but management will need the burn down. I'm like, well, look, Scrum don't even have the burn down chart as one of their artifacts anymore. Stop doing the burn down chart. And I could just see this guy like start to glaze over. But these are conversations that happen over and over and over and over and over again in Scrum. And I'm like, you know, I'm tired of these conversations. I need a system that doesn't lend itself for this stuff to happen over and over again.
Yeah, the difficulty of Scrum and these conversations among Agile coaches at many of the conferences, these happen over and over and over, where we hear about instances where they've used Scrum to deceive themselves.
Mm.
So they've put in, you know, they do the stand-up meeting, they're checking all the boxes, they had the planning meeting, but it's still iterative, incremental delivery. It's not Scrum, kind of like what you mentioned before.
Yeah.
and all of the pain points. So Scrum is great for showing you where your systems of work are inefficient or ineffective.
Yeah.
It's wonderful for that. Mm-hmm. How you decide to modify Scrum to either address it or cover it up, that's where the deception comes in. You know, once you start changing Scrum practices because you found something that made everyone uncomfortable, you've lost the benefit. And it's just way too easy to do that, especially when, and maybe we'll get into this in a little bit, when all it takes to be a Scrum Master is a two-day class.
Yeah.
And all of a sudden you're certified and you're on a team and you're the authority. And how do you know any better than to go along with what your management is saying? And sometimes you're going to end up doing what you're directed, but even the ability to conjure up logical arguments back is often missing if all you've done is a 2-day course. And I certainly see that struggle and that stress in many Agile coaches who are out in the field. And this these types of conversations that you're talking about and some of the deceptions that companies go through, I think it's just common across the industry.
Yes, exactly. And it's disheartening. And so I've kind of kept a tight lip about it because out of respect for my previous employer. But now I'm independent. I'm kind of able to be true to myself and to verbalize these things out loud. And that's kind of why I waited to launch Fast as an independent, because I didn't want to taint in any of other people's opinions, and you know, everyone's entitled to their opinion and their ways of making money. So, but I now need to be true to myself. And I was very much inspired by Tobias Meyer. So I read his book, The People Scrum. I've never read a book that is so in alignment with my way of thinking. I'm like, wow, I could have written this book. This is incredible. And I was inspired that he was courageous enough to be honest and truthful himself, to say, you know what, I'm walking away from this nonsense of certification. And this is a guy who's a CST and walked away from the Scrum Alliance because of what you described, like a 2-day certification class. Yeah. And it didn't sit right with him, and it's not sitting right with me. And we can talk about that a little more in depth if you want to as well. But it's certainly kind of, it's all part of the same picture of a lot of my frustrations around the Agile world. And I said, you know what, instead of moaning about it, I'm going to try and fix it. And that's why I created Bob. Here's my shot at trying to fix Agile.
A common theme on this podcast, especially when you have people like Amitai who comes on regularly, is the idea of XP being foundational to Agile. And that's something that I embrace quite tightly. I know that past guests like JB and Amitai believe that as well. And it was actually what we have a similar origin story with programming. As a young developer, I was fortunate enough to get a copy of Kent Beck's Extreme Programming Explained, and I read it 100 times. Mm-hmm. Loved the book. There's only good things in that book. And I was able to work in that way for a number of years, and it gives you almost a false perception of the programming industry. Right? Because once you step out of that kind of team and you see the horrors that other teams are going through, it almost just, everything else is a letdown after an amazing XP team. What if you can't get back to that? And it's just so foundational to the craftsmanship of creating software. A number that I saw today, yeah. And since you are very much, I think, a supporter of XP as much as many of us are, when I saw on the Scrum Alliance State of Scrum, I think the number was 16% of Scrum teams are using XP. And I thought to myself, how could this be possible?
Yeah.
How? And I'm hoping it's a flawed question. I'm hoping that there's some statistical imbalance that occurred that led to that kind of answer. But if that truly is the state of Scrum today, I think we might be in a little bit of trouble.
You know, I would doubt that number is correct, 16%. I'd say it was a lot lower than that. And in fact, if you looked at the, who did it, the State of Agile survey, that number is lower than that. In fact, I'm speaking at Agile 2015 next month on the topic of Scrum plus extreme programming for hyper-productivity. So it's essentially saying, look, if you want to go fast, and you're doing Scrum and you want to go fast, which is all companies seem to care about. So I've stopped trying to talk about quality because companies that are doing Scrum don't care about quality, I've come to realize. They'll pay lip service to it, but you can say, hey, I can come in and I can improve your quality, and they won't pay for that. But if you can come in and say, hey, I can make you go 3 times faster, then you've tweaked their interest. So I started talking about XP in terms of, hey, if you want to go fast, then you really need to do extreme programming. So the topic I'm talking about is Scrum plus XP for hyper productivity. And I've actually pulled in, some of those statistics from, who did that survey? It's version one,
State of Agile?
That's it. Yeah. So they got some numbers in there, and I've got a slide that kind of shows what's currently happening. And it's a great, if anyone's listening and comes along to the session. So the session is around, okay, XP is going to help you go faster, but really the main problem with XP is how to sell it to a team and to a manager. And I've come up with this fantastic little exercise. It takes about 20 minutes, where you run through this exercise. It's kind of a game. It's kind of a demonstration exercise. And at the end of it, I've never had it fail yet for the aha moment where a manager goes, okay, you need to do XP. Right. And the team saying, yes, finally, we're allowed to do XP. So yeah, it's, I'm excited to be sharing that with more people. But yeah, that number is low. It's incredibly low, and it is disheartening. And I'm hoping to kind of work on that a bit with this exercise in my session, and to share it with more people.
Yeah, it's an important topic. It's one that I wish I could see that talk. I won't be at the big conference this year, but I'm hoping that it's either recorded or it's online or some slides are available soon, because it's one of those topics that are near and dear to my heart and to this podcast. There is a very big XP streak within many of the hosts on the show, and it's foundational. I don't know how you can do Agile without an XP foundation. And I've yet to hear anyone make the argument that you should even try it. So, but then you see the numbers, and apparently a lot of people are trying it. I don't think it's working out well, especially if you look at the state of Scrum teams today.
So Scrum was designed to be rolled out quickly, and that's why they left extreme programming out, what they call the XP practices out. So it's designed to be rolled out in 2 days. And I think you can roll out Scrum in 2 days. I don't know if it'd be a very particularly good version of Scrum, but you could get a team doing Scrum. Now, extreme programming, I think it's going to take a team about 6 months. And really, to do extreme programming, there's a role in there called the XP coach, and that's a guy who kind of knows what extreme programming looks like and what the practices are, and you need an XP coach to work with. There aren't many XP coaches out there that, you know, wear like hen's teeth. And yet, I'm not getting called up and saying, hey, can you come and help us? So the challenge is to really, if you're going to do extreme programming correctly, you're going to need an XP coach, and you're going to need them to work with you for about 6 months. So I know James Shaw, and here's a fantastic example of an XP coach. And if you look on his website, the training that he offers, he will come in and work with the team for 6 months, because that's roughly what it takes. Yeah, I think that's, you know, part of the barrier to XP, in that, you know, you can't roll it out quickly. But as you said, it's the heart of Agile. In my last 15 years, I've worked with 3 high-performance teams. Of all the teams I've seen, I've only ever seen 3 high-performing, what I'd call high-performing. They were all doing extreme programming. So, you know, I've yet to see a team that wasn't doing extreme programming be high-performing.
I was just going to say, it makes me wish that we could talk Kent Beck and Ron Jeffries into rebooting the Extreme Programming Explained book and come out with a 2015, 2016 version, because I actually believe that the workforce has changed since the 90s and early 2000s. I think that whether they call it the millennial movement or whatever label you want to put on it, workers are expecting to be able to do quality work now.
Yeah.
It's no longer enough to just be paid, show up, and go home. Uh-huh. XP could have a renaissance in this new environment if it were, it makes, like I said, I wish the book had come out now. If you could reboot it and then discuss how the practices have evolved since then.
Right.
You know, pair programming has moved to mob programming.
Yes.
You know, certain estimation techniques have moved to no estimates. Mm-hmm. You know, refactoring, you know, you have all these different frameworks and methods, and you know, you have behavior-driven development, test-driven development, all these different things that have come along since,
right,
that you could almost package into a reboot of the practices and the theory and just hope for a renaissance. But I've not heard much of effort or interest in that so far.
Well, I've got that's actually my next secret project. Well, it's not actually to rewrite that book or anything like that, but yeah, I'm not sure how much to say right now, because it's my next project I'll be working on next year, which I think will address that problem. So as you can tell, I get frustrated with things, and I sit with that frustration until something kind of pops out and I go, right, I think, you know, I'm tired of moaning about it. Let's try and fix it. So I've got something that I think might be a fix. And let's talk about that offline. And if it sounds of interest to you, we can do another session on that. But yeah, watch this space.
It just seems like there is this gap. And I hope that we'll talk offline that project is looking at filling that gap, because it, you know, Ron Jeffries just came out with a new book, but it's not necessarily focused around that XP topic. And the topic has just gone away. You do still see interest in Europe, though. I have noticed that the conferences are still going, and yeah, over the pond, they love it.
Yeah.
But over here, I think you're right, in North America, the practice just kind of went away.
Yeah, I've been asking a lot of people about that. I've been meaning to write a blog, like, why has extreme programming become such a dirty word in the USA? And yet it's still a thriving practice, and people are proud to call themselves extreme programmers in Europe. And well, you can probably tell from my accent, I lived in England for a while. That's where I was introduced to extreme programming. And in fact, I'm heading back there in August, and I noticed that the Extreme Tuesday Club is still up and running. And every Tuesday, these guys meet in London. They're extreme programmers. They're proud to call themselves extreme programmers, and they talk about their craft. I think that's fantastic. I have to link in back in with them while I'm over there.
Yeah, and I just found your slide on the XP usage, and it looks like out of the 2013 survey, uh-huh, out of the total of Scrum Agile implementations reported, 15% are doing Scrum and XP. Of the entire population sample, 1% are doing just XP.
Yeah.
Mind-blowing.
Right. Yeah, given how profoundly effective it is mind-blowing. And it's kind of indicative of the state the Agile is in right now. You know, I call it the state of mediocrity that we're in. I want to get us out of it. Well, certainly the USA. It's something's really got to change.
There certainly is some truth to that, that it has happened to move into that state of mediocrity. And there's been a lot of conversations on this podcast, on other podcasts. Some people wonder if it's the move into the enterprise that was the beginning of the end, or when it was still small companies, small teams doing powerful things, if it was at that point, if that was a last moment of purity, and then it, you know, got diluted in the corporate world and the red tape and all those politics. But I think there's something deeper to it. And if I knew the answer, I'd go and come up with a certification and make a bucket of money. But
well,
and maybe
talking of certification, maybe that's where, I think you hit the nail on the head there. And so my first hunch as to the beginning of the fall, I've called it, came when I was watching a video of Uncle Bob Martin talking about the land that Scrum forgot. And it was, I think it was a keynote into, if you look it up, you'll find that the YouTube video, The Land That Scrum Forgot. And he talks there about the beginning of the end. And it was at the point where Scrum came up with the certification level. This is his theory. And when that happened, that opened Agile up to the world of the project managers. And of course, the project managers goes into the world of the enterprise and old school management thinking, which is very hard to change. So that was when Agile was diluted down into, that was the beginning of the dilution, I guess, was the creation of this Mickey Mouse certification. And yeah, okay, that is a little harsh, but you know, I don't have a problem with giving someone a certificate saying that they've done the class. And I think the CSM class is incredibly valuable. I like the content a lot. And sure, give someone a certificate saying, hey, they've sat this class. But to certify someone is very different than giving someone a certificate saying you've sat a class. To certify, I think we've made a mockery of the word by, you know, saying, hey, sit my class and then fall off a log and I will now certify you as some kind of, with some sort of expertise. And I think that's wrong. I think Tobias Meyer was right to call it out. And I think more people should start calling it out. I put a hashtag on Twitter called Say No to Agile Certification, and I've started being a bit more vocal about it. You know, maybe this is part of the healing that needs to happen, is that, you know, we start calling nonsense out and start saying no to the things that are in fact damaging to the Agile world. And I think that's one of them, like having these ridiculous certification.
I did notice that most of the certifications you did label that way, but there was one that you found value in, at least from the blog post, which I'll link to in the show notes, and that was the CST.
The CSC and the CST are, you know, the people that get those certifications they've earned them. So they're not, now, whilst they've earned them, I still question the value of them. So and that's a deeper conversation. But this, I mean, the CST, I still see value in certifying a trainer, because the ability to train effectively, and not everyone has that. So if I have a message that I want to get out to the world and to the public, and I know I can only do that by leveraging other people, then I want to have the ability to say who I trust with giving that message out. So a certification program around doing that. So the CST is an example of that. So yeah, I think those guys are very well trained in what they do, and they do a great job of it. I think the certifications they hand out are a little more questionable, and that makes me sad. But yeah, and that's why I say, you know, that there is value in that. Not that I'm interested in chasing or pursuing that. So I did entertain that thought for a while, but I'm a Microsoft certified trainer, and you know, that took training and testing to be able to get that.
Well, Ron, we're coming up on our time box, and I want to be respectful of your time, but I did want to just say I'm fascinated by FAST. I think this is it's an intriguing framework. You've turned up the best of Agile up to 12, and you've emphasized the people. And it's the first time I've really seen a framework make the individuals and interactions shine. And so I really do appreciate that. And I'm really excited to see the initial experiments and how this works out. And I think it's great that you're putting the emphasis and the spotlight back on the things that make agility actually work. So I think it really is a great thing.
Great. Thank you. Thank you. Glad it shines through.
Yeah. And at this point, if there's anything that you'd like to plug, if people would like to follow up with you about FAST or about certifications or some of the other topics we went through, how can they reach you? What's the best way to continue the conversation with you?
Yeah. So you mentioned my Twitter handle there. If you want to email me, then there's a link at the bottom of the Fast Agile website. So it's fast-agile.com. There's a contact us link there, which there's an email address you can reach me now.
Excellent. And as you mentioned, you will be speaking at Agile 2015 on Scrum and XP. If you're out there, it's foundational to agility. So if you can make that talk, I think it's going to be very educational and important. The workshop, convincing management and developers to embrace XP, that's an amazing 20-minute exercise. I'd love to see it sometime. But if you are at the big conference, please, you know, make a point to attend Ron's talk. It's an important piece of your Agile transformation. And that's it for tonight. We appreciate you listening to this episode and all the other episodes in the archives at agileanswerman.com. If you have a question, please feel free to reach out at Ryan Ripley on Twitter or use the contact page on agileanswerman.com. Thank you again for listening and have a great night.